Welcome to Critical Issues Commentary, the radio ministry of Twin City Fellowship, a non-denominational Christian church in Minneapolis, Minnesota, or on the web at cicministry.org. This is Dick Cuffell, your host for the next half hour. We're speaking today with Bob DeWay, author of Critical Issues Commentary. We're working our way through the book of Romans, chapter 11. This is our second in a series of two or three. We haven't determined yet how many there will be. We're going to be discussing the restoration of Israel today, starting with verse 11. Robert, how should we introduce this?
This is the last part of the three chapters about the issue of Israel and the Jews.
Chapters 9, 10, and 11.
Exactly. We've already talked about the remnant. We've already shown that God's purposes do not fail, that if he fulfills his purposes through a remnant and his promises through a remnant, that they are fulfilled. Yet, however, Paul is still concerned about his brethren, according to the flesh, the Jews, and their condition before God, and also the future promises that are still valid that were given to the patriarchs. And so we'll talk about that today.
Let's start with verse 11. I say then, they did not stumble so as to fall, did they? May it never be. But by their transgression, salvation has come to the Gentiles to make them jealous. Now, we could go on with that, but let's start with that one. Is our conduct suggested here?
It's giving us a purpose. There's a purpose issue here. And the purpose was not that they would stumble so as to fall permanently.
Okay, he's saying that's impossible.
That's not God's purpose. When he says, may it never be, God did not purpose that Israel would stumble and fall permanently and without any good reason or without any good benefit.
But he's speaking to the idea that something good did come out of it.
Yes, and that's going to be fleshed out in the next so many verses. We'll be talking about what good God did by allowing this stumbling, this temporary and partial hardening of some of the Jews.
Let's read verse 12 and then expand both of these to a conclusion. Now, if their transgression is riches for the world and their failure is riches for the Gentiles, how much more will their fulfillment be? We need a little explanation.
There's these two themes that we've been talking about. The present condition, that many are hardened, a remnant is believing the gospel, and yet there's future hope, and we're going to see how that works as we go through the verses here, the rest of Romans 11. Paul here is saying that there is yet a future, and that also what's happening now has its good benefit. God's purpose was not the complete downfall of the Jews, but the saving of Gentiles. As we've talked about before, had the Jews simply received their Messiah on his terms in Jerusalem and set him up as king, then how would the gospel have gone out to the Gentiles?
It would have been limited to one nation.
They would have stuck with their national fulfillment. So the rejection of Messiah by the Jews was God's ordained way of allowing the Gentiles to come in and getting the gospel out to all the nations as the Old Testament promised Messiah would do.
So were we to challenge what actually has happened, we'd be challenging God's plan.
Right. What Paul wants us to know is it may sound kind of harsh, but this plan of Jewish rejection that leads to saving of Gentiles also includes in it two things. Number one, the saving of the remnant of the Jews now and throughout history. Number two, a future national salvation for Israel that we're going to be talking about.
We'll hit some verses on that later on. 13 and 14, but I'm speaking to you who are Gentiles. Inasmuch then as I am apostle of the Gentiles, I magnify my ministry, if somehow I might move to jealousy my fellow countrymen and save some of them. What's he doing there?
Well, he's showing that even this situation of Jewish rejection of Messiah, the gospel going to Gentiles, Gentile reception of Messianic salvation, even that in itself also has a saving purpose toward the Jews. And that purpose is that they would become jealous when they see what God's doing with Gentiles, and then some of them would come and believe the gospel.
I had a little comment here saying election versus evangelization. Does that have any application here?
Election is what God has done.
There's elect Jews, there's elect Gentiles.
Right, then there's an elect nation, Israel. We'll talk about that. And then elect individuals who are the ones who actually receive the gospel and are saved. The gospel preaching is for the universal call, which we've distinguished a lot in this radio series. The universal call goes out to everyone. The internal call that is actually heard is only heard by the elect. But that's in God's hands. It's not in our hands. It's unknown to us. And so it's our charge to preach the gospel to all people, Jew and Gentile, because it's the means that God will use to save all who will be saved. And what I just said, by the way, should be agreed upon even by those who don't agree with my theology of the sovereignty of God. Even those who don't believe in election, don't believe in predestination, don't believe in an effectual call, and don't believe in effectual grace, but believe in free will, even they would have to admit that the preaching the gospel, according to the New Testament, is the means that God will use to save whoever will be saved. We're only debating over why some people respond. They say because those people exercise their free will. We would say that it's because of God's effectual grace that brought them in. But one way or the other, it's still through the preaching of the gospel. So I guess we can agree on that one.
Well, it's interesting that when I wrote down that little note to ask you about when we got to verse 14, I had little parents in there saying, golden chain. Does the golden chain apply? And you're saying yes.
Yes, it does.
Outstanding.
But there's a reason why Romans 10 follows Romans 9 and follows Romans 8. Romans 8 was the golden chain. Romans 9 was saying, well, then if God's promises cannot fail, then all he calls will actually be glorified. Well, then what about these Jews? Didn't he call them? And why aren't they being saved? Well, then Paul nuances his position, showing that God intended to save a remnant, which he has done, so nothing failed. But then he goes to Romans 10 and preaches the universal call. Whoever calls upon the name of the Lord will be saved. And how will they call upon him whom they've not heard? And how will they hear without a preacher? So you can see that in Paul's case, his belief in God's sovereign, infallible purposes certainly didn't hinder evangelism.
Outstanding. I like that. Okay. Verse 15. For if their rejection is the reconciliation of the world, what will their acceptance be but life from the dead? Wow. Let's have a couple of thoughts. Rejection, possible?
More than possible, because the conditional that Paul uses from the Greek...
Is that if, as is the case?
Yes, if, okay. As is the case.
He uses that frequently.
So we can know his meaning there. He believes that they're a rejection, well, in the sense that because they rejected Messiah and because Christ had predicted the destruction of Jerusalem, which happened in 70 AD, that now they were scattered. After that, Paul may have written before this, but it's not long after Paul wrote that happens. As is the case, will be reconciliation of the world. Well, why? Because what happened in Jerusalem, as I said earlier, led to the gospel being spread throughout the nations. Like in Acts 1, you shall be my witnesses first in Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and the uttermost parts of the world. Rejection in Jerusalem leads to salvation in Rome.
What will their acceptance be but life from the dead? The acceptance meaning when they get grafted back in?
Right, which we're going to talk about in a bit.
Okay.
The olive tree. But here it's talking about, obviously, national Israel. Some people don't want to see this here, but how can it be anything else? Because the saved remnant weren't rejected, were they?
No.
They're part and parcel of this messianic promise. So the rejection would be the mass of Israel. Okay.
Excellent.
The rejection had to be national Israel. Even our amillennial friends would have to admit that, because they claimed that national Israel was rejected. But then, was he talking about their acceptance? So he must be talking about a yet future revival of national Israel.
This would be in the Messianic reign.
I think it happens at the end of the Great Tribulation.
That becomes the restoration, and then there's the...
It starts with the bringing Israel back to the land, but that's not what this is talking about, because it's talking about not just restoring them to the land. It's talking about restoring them to a proper relationship with God, and that's only through Messiah. And that is yet future.
Second coming. Verse 16, and we'll read a little bit further than that. If the first piece of dough is holy, the lump is also. And if the root is holy, the branches are too. But if some of the branches were broken off, and you, being a wild olive, were grafted in among them, and became partaker with them of the rich root of the olive tree, do not be arrogant toward the branches. But if you are arrogant, remember that it is not you who supports the root, but the root supports you.
So what is the root?
Has to be Judaism.
Yeah, national Israel, or the promises made to the patriarchs that were embodied in Israel. The root is promises to the patriarchs, starting with Abraham. And so it's a stump root that sends up shoots. And there's still life in this root.
It's the promises in the form of covenants, and everybody understood those.
Yeah.
Right?
All the promises God made to the patriarchs that were carried forward in the history of national Israel, and that this root, these messianic promises, are still Jewish promises made to Jewish patriarchs, and that those of us who are partakers of the benefits of them are grafted into that Jewish root. This is not like a totally different thing, completely disconnected from the ancient promises. We are grafted into a Jewish olive tree. Certain kinds of trees, when you cut them down, the stump stays alive. I've used this in my Sunday school class as an illustration. We bought a house in 87, and I couldn't understand. All these little trees kept coming up in my yard, and spraying them with 2,4-D didn't do any good at all. And I'd pull them out, go around, pull all these little trees out, and I'd mow them down and try to spray them, and I was just having all kinds of problems. Well, then we had this drought, which killed the whole yard, and still these little trees are coming up. I had to replant the yard anyhow, so I dug around in the yard. Underneath the soil was this whole root system from a tree. There was one of these kind of trees where you can cut it down, but the root stays alive, and it'll send up these shoots that can turn into another whole tree.
Oh, wow.
And I was never able to stop that until, so I dug a great big hole and chopped and cut and got my four-wheel drive truck and pulled that whole root out. And we finally got rid of our problem with these trees trying to come up in the yard. But that's the kind of tree that the Old Testament uses prophetically, the root of Jesse. It's a stump root that it's not dead. The promises are alive, and there will come from this seemingly barren stump root that now Gentiles have been grafted into. There will one day be this full-fledged Jewish olive tree.
This comment on arrogance seems to be really quite a warning.
Yes, and sadly a warning that has not been heeded in much of church history.
Example.
Well, how about the Crusades? Here are Christians off on a crusade to kill Jews and to capture the Holy Land for Christians. Had they read this chapter, they would have no such attitude. I don't see how anything in Paul's writing would give anybody an anti-Semitic understanding of life or history.
Especially if you look at just the words, arrogant toward the branches. Remember that it is not you who supports the root, but the root supports you. They obviously said there was no connection.
Yeah, they just took it over. It's called what we call replacement theology. They say the church is Israel. Israel is nothing. Israel is apostate, so God took all of her promises, gave them to us, and she's dead, and that's the end of it. There is no Israel. And having said that, then they felt justified in their anti-Semitism. But according to this verse, arrogance towards Jews is sinful. And we have salvation because a promise is made to the Jews and the redemptive work of a Jewish Messiah. So having received these things, we should have Paul's attitude. He says, my heart's prayer for my brethren, the Jews, is their salvation.
It's interesting, though, he always comes up about the next thought that you might possibly have in verse 19. Verse 19 says, you will say then, branches were broken off so that I might be grafted in. He's talking about that arrogance and saying, hey, hold it, hold it. They were getting moved out of the way for me.
That's not really a good attitude. A much better attitude is just to see the mercy of God, that I don't deserve to be here. I can't believe God is so gracious to let me, a sinful Gentile, into these great messianic promises.
So our being grafted in is not replacing Israel?
No. We're being grafted into Israel. And the promises are still real for the Jews and for Israel. That's what this chapter is telling us. And any time God does something beneficial for anyone, be they Jew or Gentile, the only proper response isn't to boast toward somebody else, but to realize the unmerited favor that we've been shown. And that, but by the grace of God, there go I.
Quite right. Verses 20 and 21. They were broken off for their unbelief, but you stand by your faith. Do not be conceited, but fear, for if God did not spare the natural branches, he will not spare you either. Now, We've got a few things to talk about there.
It's a warning against apostasy. Be duly warned. And this is not an unusual in Paul. In 1 Corinthians 10, he said that the things that happened to them happened for our examples, and the example was, don't go after evil things. It says in 1 Corinthians 10:11, now these things happened to them as an example, and they were written for our instruction, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. Therefore, let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. The conclusion isn't that, oh, look at all those sinful Jews. It's a good thing God has us. No, 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 no. The conclusion is, take heed. Take the warning seriously, because we could fall into the same state.
Does this go against the idea of eternal security?
Not at all. I don't believe it does. I wrote an article on this. It's on our website, Hebrews 6:4-8 on apostasy. But I believe that the warning is absolutely valid. And I do believe that if a truly regenerate Christian were to curse God, blaspheme Christ, renounce the gospel, renounce his faith, and go out and spend the rest of his life living like an unbeliever, and died in that state, that such a person would go to hell. However, I don't believe God's going to ultimately allow that to happen. He'll even turn us over to Satan for the destruction of the flesh if needs be. He'll do everything to get us back. So I wouldn't recommend doing any of those sort of things. It would be very, very, very bad. But the warning is there for the truly elect to take seriously so that we don't crave evil things, as it says in 1 Corinthians 10. We need to take it seriously. And if we don't, I heard one preacher say one time, and I agree with his sentiment, he says when the elect read these verses, it scares the hellishness out of them. But when the non-elect read it, they think this, oh, I don't have to be concerned because I'm eternally secure.
Oh, man, you know, it's not funny, but it's amazing what we do with thinking sometimes.
Well, it's a good way to look at it. So that if we take this with due seriousness, it's a good sign that we're truly regenerate.
And I agree with that. Okay, verse 22. Behold, then, the kindness and severity of God. To those who fell, severity, but to you, God's kindness, if you continue in his kindness, otherwise you will be cut off.
There we go again. A valid warning. Absolutely valid warning. And I think every preacher is obligated to preach this as strongly as you preach the passages on assurance. God put everything that's in the Bible there for a reason. Preaching all of it will give us the balanced view of the Christian life that God wants.
So it's saying that God is kind and he is severe.
Yes, it's the whole counsel of God. And by the way, just theologically, so you understand, God's kindness and God's severity are both true all the time.
How?
Because God isn't like us. We can only be one thing at a time. One moment we're angry, another moment we're not.
Hey, I can't even multitask.
Okay. So we tend to think that God's just like us, which isn't true. All of the attributes of God, including his love and his justice, coexist in God simultaneously for all eternity. Because God says, I, the Lord, change not. So he doesn't become a loving God at one point and an angry God at another and then back to a loving one. God is always both kind to sinners and opposed to evil all the time.
To build on that point, verse 23 says, and they also, if they do not continue in their unbelief, will be grafted in, for God is able to graft them in again.
Amen. True security rests not in our abilities, but true security rests on the mercy and grace of God, not any kind of self-dependence.
Well, that statement is really hope for Israel.
Yes, God is able to bring them back, and there's hope for Israel, and he can do a miracle of grace. And we'll see, as Paul develops this thought here, that it would be a natural thing for God to do so, because they received the promises. They've had all these centuries of a history of interacting with God and his promises. It's their Messiah. It's their patriarchs. It's their scriptures. The New Testament was written by Jews. If God does the strange thing, saves Gentiles, well, how much more would he do what we'd expect and save Jews?
Wow. Verse 24, for if you were cut off from what is by nature a wild olive tree and were grafted contrary to nature into a cultivated olive tree, how much more will these who are the natural branches be grafted into their own olive tree? An interesting summary of some of Leon Morris's work. He said, the tough part was reaching you Gentiles, speaking to the Gentiles in Rome. The easy part would be regrafting the Jews.
Amen. That's Paul's argument. It's this very typical Jewish argument from lesser to greater. If God does the greater, saves Gentiles, how much more will he do the lesser, which is bringing messianic salvation to the people to whom it was originally promised?
You know, though, the Gentiles, I'm sure, don't see that as an easier thing. It's like, you can't, how are you talking to these people?
We look at it as a most impossible task, the evangelism of Jews. And it has been very difficult, especially since church history is rife with anti-Semitism and hatred of Jews and things that have turned Jewish people off to the gospel and to the claims of Christ. However, we need to realize that ultimately saving of Jews is God's work through the gospel. And we need to be faithful in preaching it and proclaiming it. In the end, it's God's supernatural work of grace that brings anybody to him. We tend to look at people and judge how hard it would be to evangelize them compared to how hard it would be to someone else. We look at two persons, and one of them is nice, kind neighbor that's happy and smiling all the time, and we might think, oh, he'd make a good Christian. As if God needed some material that had something in and of itself to work with. And then we look at this other person who's this nasty drunkard that doesn't mow his lawn and is antisocial and yells and screams at his kids down the street. We think, well, boy, that would be a hard one to reach with the gospel. Many times it's just the opposite. Many times it's these unlikely ones that God chooses in order to show that it's all of his grace. So when we look out there at the various people groups, including Jewish ones, we should only see the fact that the gospel is intended for all peoples. And Paul's point is, it was originally given to Jews, how natural it should be that they would be the recipients of it, especially at the very end of the age.
Let's talk about that aspect of faith comes by hearing and hearing by the word of Christ. They focused on the idea of hearing, and I want to speak a little bit to what our ministry is here for just a moment, if we could take a minute or two. We don't just do hearing. We're doing radio here today, but we're talking about video and making a number of things. Does that all come under that same commission?
Yeah, our focus is gospel preaching.
But that's preaching.
Yes. However, we go out on the street, and we have music and food, and we get up and share the gospel, and we have gospel workers praying with people. Every Sunday morning, I share the gospel. That's in the course of preaching through the whole Bible. We preach Old Testament, Gospels, Epistles, verse by verse, as we work our way through the Bible for forever. Okay?
What are we doing with that to get it beyond the walls here at Twin City Fellowship?
Right now, on our website, if you click on by 1 o'clock Sunday afternoon, you will have a video of the service and an audio. And so if you have high-speed access, you can watch the video of our church service by Sunday afternoon. And people are doing so all over the world. But all the more why every Sunday I or Ryan shares the gospel, the basic things about who Jesus is, what he did, the cross, the resurrection, and the need to repent and believe the gospel. Sunday after Sunday after Sunday, that is the gospel. Because you don't know who's there. You don't know how many people may have been coming to church for 10 years and are not yet truly converted. Besides that, the gospel has a sanctifying effect on Christians.
In what way?
Because we need to be reminded of the blood of Christ, of forgiveness of sins, and of the basis of our faith, because it brings us joy. Just think about communion. Isn't communion about remembering what Christ has done for us? He says, do this in remembrance of me. So if all we had to do was get it down in our head once, okay, I got it. Jesus died, Jesus rose, okay. I got it down on my head. Then why have communion?
It's a good example.
We have it because it's such a fantastic work of grace that God has done, that we receive grace in the process of reminding ourselves of these things and sharing these things with each other as we come and as we go. Just like in the Old Testament, hear, O Israel, the Lord your God is one. Tell these things to your kids, coming in and going out, coming in and going out. This isn't something you get once and then you're done with it. This is a lifelong thing of receiving what God has for us through the gospel. So it brings benefit to Christians, just like singing gospel songs. I've been a Christian since 1971. But when we sing songs about the blood atonement and about God's marvelous grace and about what he's done for us, it touches me like it did 30 years ago. So we have a lifetime need for these truths, and the gospel should be preached in every pulpit in America or anywhere in the world every day till the Lord returns.
I'm with you on that one. That's it for today, folks. For those of you who might want to contact us or visit our church, we're Twin City Fellowship in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Our telephone number is 952-935-3100, or you can find us on the web at cicministry.org. For Critical Issues Commentary, this is Dick Cuffell
and Bob Duway.
See you next week.